It is not going to be the answer to the obesity epidemic. We cannot put every human being on this medication, even if we wanted to, right? So there are other ways to get these results without these medications, potentially. But I think it comes back to that genetic component that you were mentioning, where I think that people can't expect that they're going to get such significant results without these meds, because in a lot of ways, these meds are shutting off things that are potentially genetically related and hard to shut off without a medication intervention.
Hello and welcome back to all of our listeners, to my sisters. Welcome to It's Beyond the Food, the Feminist Wellbeing Podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Dozier, non-diet nutritionist, certified intuitive eating counselor, and cognitive behavior coach. And in case it is your first time in my world, I have earned a PhD in diet culture at the age of 40 when I graduated from 25 years of dieting. And today I'm here to guide you on how to feel damn good about yourself, about your life, about your body, not by shrinking your body, but by reshaping your mind. In this podcast, we go beyond the food and fight diet culture and patriarchy by living powerfully. And we are back after almost a 4 months break from the podcast. I don't know if you can feel it in my voice, but I'm like beyond excited, filled with energy, filled with creativity to bring you probably somewhere around 50 episodes in 2024 on how we can take this journey together and expand our well-being. And today we're going to kickstart with a punch. As some of you may know, we are in March 2024. Just last week, or 10 days ago, as I'm recording this, Oprah did a TV special on her latest and greatest epiphany about weight loss. So I decided to pull in this bubble of creativity in which I've been sitting on for 4 months and create a special show for you. I formatted this show to be a, quote, post-game analysis, and I brought in an analyst to review what was shared during Oprah's TV special, the truth, what is not true, what we can trust, what we shouldn't be trusting, where should we be taking this information in our life. My co-host for this episode is Dr. Natalie Gentile. You may recognize her from a recent episode number 358, where we talked about the Ozempic weight loss drug. So when I saw that Oprah was doing this special TV show on weight loss, I grabbed my phone, went on Instagram, DM'd Dr. Natalie Gentile and says, what about if we do a part two to the episode we had already put out into the world? And we do it under a fun thematic of a post-game analysis. And she jumped right in. So my team is going to patch in now the interview. And I want to set the tone for you. Prior to recording the episode, me and Natalie did not have a conversation about what we're going to talk about, what we're going to share in this post-game analysis. So it is a raw conversation between two human beings about the show. And I'm going to remind you on who Dr. Natalie Gentile is. Dr. Natalie Gentile is a board-certified family medicine and lifestyle medicine physician who owns a direct primary care practice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And she practices in a weight-neutral approach to health that creates a safe space for all the people. Ready? Let's do this. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gentile.
Hi, thank you.
So we have not talked before I press record for a reason. Because I'm formatting this show to be a post-game analysis.
I love that.
You like the theme, right? So here's what I'd like to do in the proper post-game analysis. What is your first comment on the game, on the Oprah weight loss drug show, Dr. Gently? I know.
Okay. My first instinct was, it was nicely done. I felt like it was nicely put together. Then my second feeling was, this felt forced. So those are my gut instincts.
That's okay. I'll give you my gut instinct as a coach. What I saw was deep trauma playing out.
Sure. I mean, if we're going to get right into it, I would agree on that one.
Like I just saw the trauma of a 70-year-old woman who's been treated terribly by society, by the media, and has not freed herself. And it was playing out on the stage of millions of people. And I just had the deepest compassion for this woman.
I had deep compassion for everybody on that show.
Yeah, sure.
Including the people from the pharmaceutical. I mean, literally everyone I had compassion for, because this is such a challenging situation, number one, with lots of trauma for especially the patients, including Oprah, number two. Number three, though, there's so much hope you can see in what these people were saying that I also felt for them, that like, I was happy for them that if they truly felt this way, you know, that they were at a position now where they felt happy and well with themselves and there was hope. I was happy for them because I can't imagine how awful they'd felt for so long.
Absolutely. I think that's a great perspective as well. Here's what I'd like to do now after giving our first impression. As a weight neutral physician, I would like to clarify some of the big soundtrack to bring truth, perhaps where there was confusion around, based on the feedback from my listeners, from my followers, some of the things, some of the concepts that were thrown around, and I want to get your perspective on it instead of just the physician from the weight loss company, because the two, three physician present on the show were declared and upfront as paid by the weight loss drug company.
Yeah, let's do it.
You are not paid by the weight loss drug company.
I sure am not.
So here's the first word I want to throw out there that we heard over and over again. The obesity is a disease. Must have been mentioned like, if not 20 times, 50 times. What's the truth there?
Yeah. So literally obesity was deemed a disease, just like when we talk about diabetes, hypertension, et cetera, et cetera. So that's absolutely true that it was, you know, classified as such. What that opens doors for. So I'm playing devil's advocate here, Steph.
I just mention one thing? It's yes. Classified as a disease in the United States.
Okay.
But it's not in Canada.
Yeah.
I'm not going to comment anymore. I won't interrupt you. I just want to say there's two different perspectives on this. So let's get the American door opening situation for.
Yeah, let's talk about what that opens doors for. Again, I'm coming at this completely just objectively and how I see it play out with patients. When we have a label of a disease for anything in our country, in the US, it allows for insurance coverage for interventions. Whether you agree with what those interventions are or not, it allows the opportunity for them for patients. And so, you know, that potential is, I don't see as a bad thing. Okay. Now, obesity being classified as a disease can, for some people, I'd say, trigger this thought of there's something wrong with me because I struggle with obesity. And that is, again, another thing that we could dive into and talk about. But, you know, to answer your question, yes, in the US, it's been classified as a disease.
In your perspective, and I know you're probably not aware of this, why in Canada it's not, but my gut feeling tells me is because we have a different medical system. We're under like governmental care. So there's no need for insurance-based acceptance of a disease. Would I be correctly somehow thinking about that?
Yeah, I'd say that would make a lot of sense, that explanation. Now, we could also look at this from another perspective, which I honestly don't fully think is the case, because I really try not to be cynical. I really try not to, you know, be cynical, although I sometimes am, you know, and how could you not be going through what we see in the medical system? But there is, in the United States, this, you know, war on obesity for decades, right? And the obesity epidemic being touted in the media over and over and over again. And so I think there is also this, you know, demonizing of people who struggle with obesity and who are obese. There is also the weaponizing of it. And I think when we call something a disease, we give it that opportunity. But again, I'd say that's more of a cynical perspective, because for those of us in the medical community that truly are like working to help people get better, if we have something classified as a disease, and truly, you know, if you see in the literature that it bears out that it is looking like a disease process, then now we can give people the help they need.
Yeah. Okay. Second point that was less mentioned, but that was part of the marketing jingle for the show, was the obesity gene. Now, this one's a new one to me. So what's up with this gene of obesity?
So there is evidence out there and more understanding as time goes on that there is definitely a genetic component to obesity. And now let's look at, again, the ways that this could bear out. There is evidence that there is genetic component to obesity. And I think a lot of, you know, they did mention in that show a little bit, and we see a lot in other literature, this kind of weight set point that people have, where no matter how much they diet cycle and lose weight and lose weight, they always kind of come back to a certain weight, right? Or a certain body frame. And that makes us start to think there could be, this is your body and this is just the way your body is, right? And if we keep trying to fight that, we're hitting our head up against a wall. And that also leans into this thought of there being a genetic component to the way our bodies are made and how they are going to look phenotypically, right? There's a genotypic explanation to how our bodies phenotypically or how they externally present.
Where I see the problem is when we classify obesity as a disease and we say you have the gene of the disease, instead of saying you have a genetic of a, quote, larger, bigger body. Because so now it's saying you have a gene of a disease.
Ah, interesting.
Do you get what I'm saying?
Is it the word obesity, or tell me more, like explain that more.
So I'll take me as an example. Like we just happened to talk about me and I have full consent to talk about me, right? So I live in a large body and I was 12 years old and I was in a larger, taller, wider body. So I had the gene of a larger body. But does that mean then that I have a gene for the obesity disease? Do you see what I'm saying? Now you get it, right?
Yes, I do. I do get it. Yeah. And, you know, they did mention on that show, and I agree with, you know, and we see this play out, you can have a larger body and not have the diseases that we see associated with obesity, right? And on the flip side, and I think you and I touched on this,
on the first episode.
Yeah. So I agree with what you're saying, because here we're using obesity, a disease, but we're also using the word obesity literally to describe a body size.
Exactly. That's where I'm like hung up, because yeah, I have the gene of a larger body, just like I have the gene of brown hair. I have the gene of white skin.
Yes.
Does that mean I have a disease? No, because I am very gracefully privileged to not have any of those quote unquote disease of obesity. Yeah. So I kind of break the rule.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, you know, a lot of being practicing in a weight neutral way, yeah. So much of how I practiced before, even 3 years ago, I'm talking real recent stuff, that my, you know, approach was, if I could get everybody to lose weight, they will be healthy.
Absolutely.
That's how I was taught, right? And so there's this, I hear what you're saying is, if we give it the power of there's an obesity gene, they're going to be sick, we have to fix the sickness. That's a challenge, right? That's a challenging thought process. We kind of need to dial it back and say, let me assess the person who is in a larger body, determine if there are disease processes, whether they're related to weight or not, and then treat them as such.
Yeah. So there's not a gene that's been detected that we could get with 22andMe. Boom, you've got the gene of the disease of obesity. There's no such thing yet, correct? It's just theory at this point.
Yes. And, you know, some of these genes that are being looked at to try and understand what might lead a person to having a larger body or disease processes from weight, you know, excess weight. Yes, those things. But it's not like people are finding that out yet, like you mentioned, from a 23andMe.
It's a theory at this point that has no like clear methodology of determination.
Sure, like in clinical practice, right? In a lab, absolutely. You know, those things are coming out, but in clinical practice is not there yet.
Okay. So we'll go into the third point that came very clearly was the medication and the various claim or affirmation that were made based on the medication. I want to say, again, I want to reinforce that the doctor that made those claims were clinician for the drug company. One of the things that struck out to me was they mentioned they've been using these drugs for weight loss for 20 years. And it just blew my mind because I thought the FDA just gave approval not even 2 years ago.
My understanding, yeah, I'd have to look back at the literal, like the text of the episode, but my understanding from watching the episode was they were alluding to the fact we've been using these meds, some of these meds for diabetes for that long. Yes. And noticing that there is weight loss, but the indication, as you mentioned, is a much more recent thing. And we should clarify, they're talking specifically about Ozempic, the semaglutide one, you know, the tirzepatide, we're talking newer. You know,
what's the difference? So yes. You clearly know more than me on those various medication. There's two categories.
There's four meds out now that are kind of the hot ones that are being talked about. So let's talk about category one, which are going to be our GLP-1 agonists. Okay. That's if you hear GLPs, you know, for short, that's what's being talked about. These medications are on the market as Ozempic and Wegovy. Those are the brand names. The generic of those or the active component of those is semaglutide, okay? This medications, that's the one they're talking about, has been used for so long for our diabetic patients. Now, Ozempic, and this is where it gets real interesting because this is where the pharmaceutical kind of shenanigans come into play. Ozempic is approved for diabetes. Wegovy, same medication, but different doses, is for weight loss, okay? Now let's talk about tirzepatide. This is Mounjaro and Zepbound. Okay. Tirzepatide uses that GLP-1 agonist, but it also uses a GIP agonist. So it's two receptors that are being stimulated, okay, and involved here. And this is Mounjaro and Zepbound. Now Mounjaro is for diabetes. Zepbound was just recently brought to market and approved for weight loss. So you see where we're working here? We've got the same med, but now we get to play an extra game of my patient, for example, has been on Mounjaro for 2 years. Well, hey, now they aren't diabetic. They have to be on Zepbound, but we won't cover Zepbound. Sorry. You know, we get to play a whole new game with insurance companies. But when they're talking about those medications, that's what we're talking about, is kind of those big four main players.
Okay, so that's cool. So when we heard they've been used for 20 years, they've been used in the context of diabetes management as they were intended in the first place.
Correct.
And the variation that they're using for weight loss has another name, but it's the same pharmaceutical pathways into the body. They just are targeted for weight loss.
Correct. And to be fair, Wegovy is going to be slightly different doses than Ozempic, same med.
Okay. So the question then becomes, we are promoting on this show the usage of these drugs for weight loss. And we're very clear that it's not for a lifetime. We're clear saying it's for a period of time. I'm assuming true weight loss. What happens after?
So they mentioned it in the show, and I am, you know, eyes wide open. I make sure when I'm counseling patients, these are a lifetime medication for the maintenance of what you are losing. So let's talk about, we're just using them for weight loss. Okay.
Yeah.
We're just talking about weight. These are intended to be for life. And what's happening when people stop taking them is the weight comes back.
And that's demonstrated in research. Like, it's not a hidden fact.
No.
So why are your patients who are well-educated still choose to go on it knowingly that they will regain the weight? Is it because they're intending to take it for a lifetime? Because it must be expensive, isn't it?
Let's look at, you know, if you watching that episode on Oprah and seeing the way that those people felt, right? Let's hope they're not acting, right? Like, they're for real.
No.
And what they're portraying is what so many people are portraying and feeling sitting across from me in my office every day when we're talking about weight. And it is, as you mentioned, trauma. It is traumatic for them to go through life in a bigger body, being treated differently and having different access to healthcare and having different social situations than people in a smaller body. You know, it is a lifelong, for some people, battle of diet cycling and not feeling good in their own minds and bodies. And so when you present them with a medication that could potentially solve that and quiet the mind, when they talked about, you know, whatever you call it.
Yeah, I want to talk about this in just a minute.
You know, the opportunity to shut up those voices in your head, of course, a lot of people are going to want that, you know? And so even being in a weight neutral practice, right? Even practicing that way, I absolutely help people lose weight. I help them gain weight. I help them not talk about weight, right? Like, I approach them each with that tailored care. But I can see how much this has helped people. And so when you say, like, why are they choosing to do that? It's a lot of times because they do not want to go back to how they've been feeling for some of them 30, 40 years, you know?
But they will at some point by regaining the weight. Or will the voice receptor be totally turned off and they'll be able to be back in their body but not have the internalized fat phobia?
The assumption is they will stay on it. Now, some people try to go off of it, you know, or they stay at low doses of it for kind of a maintenance and they try to go off of it. And maybe they won't regain all the weight. They likely will regain some of it just because of what we see in the studies, as you mentioned.
So let's talk about risk, because that is the big other component. They mentioned in the show that there is some risk, but overall, the long-term research does not identify some significant risk. So my question is this: how can we have done long-term research when it's just been approved for weight loss? Or what am I missing there?
Well, if we look at semaglutide, you know, there's, as they mentioned, decades of info now on that medication, right?
So
we
know diabetes.
Yes.
Okay.
So we know what that's doing. And interestingly, Wegovy, also semaglutide, but the one that's approved for weight loss, was just FDA approved as being used for heart disease risk reduction in our patients who are at high risk for that. In our, you know, patients that are struggling with weight and also have that heart disease risk, it has that potential. I mean, as a physician, I'm like, this is awesome, right? This is fantastic. We don't want people having heart disease who are at high risk for that. So, you know, there is so many years of data that have shown the safety and efficacy of that type of medication, but that does not mean it's without risk.
So what are the risks you discuss with your patient?
So one of the main risks that I talk with people is about tolerability. Like, how are you tolerating this, right? Day in and day out, when we have that decreased gastric emptying, for example, or people are feeling fuller more quickly, we have slowing of how food is moving through the GI tract, people can feel unwell. They can have, you know, diarrhea or really bad constipation on the flip side. They can have nausea. I also find that patients are really struggling to remind themselves to eat when they have such diminished appetite. So there's the potential, you know, for decreased nutrition in general.
Nutrition deficiency. Mm-hmm. Is there any research specifically around, because my audience is women, you know, perimenopausal, menopausal women, losing muscle mass, bone health. Is there any connection with that for this particular group of people?
Excellent question. I mean, let's just look across the board. First of all, there's the potential for decrease in muscle mass. And then, so then add that on top of perimenopausal and menopausal women at higher risk of sarcopenia or decreased muscle mass, or at least difficulty gaining muscle mass, right?
Which or absorbing calcium for just one micronutrient.
So yes, there is the added, you know, issue when you're on these medications of that happening, which is why when we're counseling patients about these medications, it is imperative that we're talking about strength training, you know, consistent resistance training, consistent eating, and appropriate intake of the macro and micronutrients that you need.
So I want to be clear for people listening. The research that has quoted as long-term was done in the context of managing type 2 diabetes. Since the drug's just been approved widely for weight loss for, well, say 3 years, but it could be even shorter than that, the specific research on risk specifically for weight loss are a maximum of whatever, 2 to 3 years. Is that correct?
Sure, likely a little bit longer than that. But yes, and we're not talking 20 years from the weight loss side of things. So, you know, we have to keep in mind that, again, this is the same med, but, you know, the weight loss side of things, this is different. Sure.
But I'm just thinking type 2 diabetes, which is not reversible. So you're heading towards a certain direction. If this drug can prevent insulin, then you're preventing a bunch of other health condition that usually comes along with insulin. Am I not correct?
Yes, that is correct. So I do want to clarify, type 2 diabetes, we can have reversal of that. You know, we can have patients have reversal of type 2 diabetes, not with these medications, which is great. You know, to be fair, with these medications, there's so much of a risk-benefit conversation that we need to have with patients that they may go off of it because of side effects, or they may tolerate it because they so badly want the potential weight loss benefits of it, right? And I see that too. I have patients just kind of stomaching it, for lack, you know, no pun intended, because of the desire for the long-term weight loss.
And just to be clear, in the United States, when it's prescribed for weight management, it's out-of-pocket expense. Is that correct?
Not always.
Not always.
The next really interesting layer of that onion is, in the United States, so many people have so many different health insurance plans. And within one company, you could have so many different iterations of that plan. And in the United States, so much of our health insurance is employer related. So it's employer covered. So depending on where you work, you get your health insurance from that employer. So then you go and switch jobs, you have a different insurance. So then the employer is, I'm not paying all these premiums this year, I'm getting a different plan. So the next year you have a different plan. And so what we ran into very fascinatingly, and I say that sarcastically, this fall, for example, when insurance plan rolled over for different companies, some of my patients that were on these meds and it was covered, all of a sudden, November hits and I'm getting letters like, oh, sorry, this isn't covered anymore. So, I mean, this is now, you know, patients can go off of these meds because of side effects. Patients might go off these meds because all of a sudden it's not covered by insurance and they cannot afford it. And it's $1,000+ a month.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. See, in Canada, it's very simple. If you don't have type 2 diabetes, it's not covered. So that just ends that conversation.
So even it's not even being covered for the indications of weight loss.
No. Wow. Again, two different countries, and I don't know, I'm sure European country have a whole other, but so what do we do with a patient who's been on it and can't have it? So then they will suffer the reversal of what they've gained, or there's no way of mitigating that?
So yeah, so then it's a matter of going down the process of what's called prior authorizations, which is me spending hours of time talking to insurance companies, trying to figure out, can we get this to work? convincing them, when I'm the one practicing medicine, taking care of the patients, convincing them of my medical decision-making, which is a just extremely painful process. The other thing is, when we run out of all options and they won't cover it at all, then we're talking about the other medications that are indicated for weight loss in our country, which have been around for a long time, but are not nearly as effective. A lot of the different oral medications that are out there.
Okay. I'd like to bring you into the track of the getting my brain back, removing the voice in my head. Like, that was like a good chunk of the first part. And she had multiple people saying that the voice in my head stopped, that there is a specific I'm assuming, receptor that this medication binds to that then controls the thinking process. What's up with all of that? What's the real story and how does it really work? Because I have my own other opinion from like cognitive behavioral coaching about what creates a thought. And it was, I was led to believe it's a receptor that could just remove all the thoughts in your head.
Yeah. So, you know, these medications are working through the GLP-1 and the potentially with those two meds we talked about, GIP receptors. And it is pretty remarkable to see it in clinical practice happen where these patients, not everybody, okay, and I should say this, okay, not every patient, but there are patients who are experiencing that, where it is shutting off that whole constant soundtrack in their minds about, and honestly, like the things that Oprah said, I'm hearing patients say, I can't stop thinking about food. I think about the next meal. I'm guilty about the previous meal. What am I going to eat? You know? And patients are saying, I don't even have interest in food anymore. I just don't even think about it. I don't have that sensation. Now, for some people, that can be awful, right? To not have interest in food anymore and not enjoy it. And that's
the other side.
Sure, right? We see it kind of, the pendulum swings. But there are a lot of patients, especially interestingly, my patients, for example, that have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, right? These patients where their brain is already a soundtrack, right? For other reasons. And then food tends to be a manifestation of that for them. And they get that shut off and they feel so free from it, which is interesting. Now we're starting to see some literature coming out about the potential for the use of these meds in people with addiction. So it's all got to be related, right? These receptors that you're talking about, these pathways, these neural pathways, where there's a lot of overlap between food and the obsession about food and OCD and addiction, right? They're all overlapping in different ways that some of these medications are bearing out to be potentially helpful for.
But okay, so I hear you that we see it in clinical practice, but there's not, I want to be clear, there's not yet a known process of why this is happening. We just see the consequence of it, but we're not saying the drug binds to this receptor, which then turns off the cognitive brain thinking process. There's just observation, but we don't know quite yet why.
I've not seen why, but I have not consumed every single paper. You know what I mean? Every single possible paper, especially in that literature along the lines of like the addiction stuff is just coming out. I'm not seeing every single piece of literature yet. So I don't want to speak out of turn, but my understanding is that we don't have a nailed down neural pathway where we can say it's this specific place where we can shut it off. But I think we're definitely, what I'm seeing in the literature is narrowing down on what those pathways are.
The reason why I'm saying that is in my side of the world where I deal with psychology and behavioral, when I think the voice is turned off, what I hear is my internalized fat phobia is like turning off because now I have the weight loss. Now I feel better about myself, right? So it's the voice of internalized fat phobia, the self-shaming, the restriction voice. Because when you don't have to restrict food, you don't have the rebellious behavior, like bouncing back, making you obsess about food. That's how I interpret the voice.
That is very, very deep. Yes. And I don't know that answer, right? And you can't know that answer for each individual person.
I mean, if pathologically they could tell me, yes, it's the receptor on this cell that does this, I'm like, okay, my theory doesn't stand out, but right now they can't. So I'm like, it could be both.
Now, the only thing I will say, this is clinical practice, this is anecdotal, is I'm seeing that commentary before the weights even started coming off, which is interesting. Sure. Right? Because it's almost immediate with the medication itself. But like you're saying, is it almost, I'm on something that I know is going to lead to this. Yes, I hear you.
It's the, what I call the dieting voice.
Yes.
Because like when you're about to go on a drug, like when you're signing up for the plan, when you're signing up for Weight Watcher, when you go to the gym, all of a sudden the voice goes down because now you're going to plan of attack.
Yes.
It's the shame voice.
Sure. Who's to say it's not all of the above? Right?
What I want to get through to people is that those voices that we have yet that people observe going down, it's not the only way to get it down. There's other ways without having to take a medication to like change the voice in your head.
Completely 100% agree with you on that. And the problem where we run into with these medications, which is why we are in such significant shortage of these medications, right? is that there's this discussion that it is the be all end all. It is the answer for all of our concerns about weight in this world. It is not going to be the answer to the obesity epidemic. Like the answer, we cannot put every human being on this medication, even if we wanted to, right? So there are other ways to get these results without these medications potentially. But I think it comes back to that genetic component that you were mentioning, where I think that people can't expect that they're going to get such significant results without these meds, because in a lot of ways, these meds are shutting off things that are potentially genetically related and hard to shut off without a medication intervention.
I'm going to get us back on the track of fat phobia, internalized, and weight shaming. And I'm going to share a post or a quote from a post from a fat activist, and I'm going to link it in the show notes. Her name is Virgie Tovar. She's one of the most well-known fat activists. And she commented on how the show and Oprah said that this drug, we're going to end diet culture and fat phobia. Okay, so I'm going to read her statement from here. She says, it's like saying that we can solve racism by medically altering everyone's melanin so they can be white, or saying that we can end homophobia by forcing everyone to be straight. Quote from Virgie Tovar. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I'm over here like, yeah.
Yeah, you were like fist up.
Oh my gosh, that resonates with me so much. I heard a similar sentiment from another fat activist on a podcast recently as well. You know, we aren't fixing fat phobia by trying to get people in smaller bodies. We are not fixing that underlying condition. I completely agree with that. And regardless of using these medications or not, that is not helping our underlying issue of people's relationships with their bodies and the relationships that the healthcare industry, you know, speaking from my perspective, have of people with bigger bodies.
Yeah, it's like saying the solution to fat shaming, weight stigma, medical weight stigma is complying. That's the solution. Not changing our mindset, but comply to be in a thinner body. And this is where I'm going to wrap it up to the beginning of the show, the conversation, which is what I saw was trauma. What I saw playing out is how we see trauma play one-to-one basis in our practice. But the difference is that it's on the world stage.
Yeah. Bless Oprah for being out there and putting that out there and seeing it, because that is true trauma, which she has experienced. It is hard because there are people who do need these medications. They do. And it drastically helps them from a health perspective. But there, I think when we start to try to use it as some kind of be-all, end-all solution for people and think that it is going to fix fat phobia, or it's going to truly even fix our own internal fat phobia, mm-hmm. I don't think that's the answer.
Which is going to get me to the last component that I wanted your thoughts on, this post-game show analysis, is the American Academy of Pediatrics, right? So we saw the interview with the 16-year-old who had bariatric surgery and it didn't work. And then there was multiple statements that her life was going to end by the time she's 18. Now, I think from my limited medical knowledge that we can't predict that. That was just fear-based motivational claim by a physician, or can we really predict that?
I don't think there are great models out there to predict something like that, but I can absolutely see that conversation playing out in real life.
Yeah.
Yes.
So apparently now, from reading further and doing research for this show, it is a true recommendation from the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, to put children or over 12 years old on weight loss drug and or bariatric surgery. What are your thoughts on that? Or how would you approach a child?
Yeah. So I think, again, these are different categories of people and what they are experiencing, where the clinical nuance comes into play. So if you've got a patient in front of you, pretty much regardless of age, who has severe fatty, I mean, if what they're describing this young woman had,
yeah,
you know, fatty liver disease, diabetes, right? It's like severe mobility issues secondary to weight. If we're starting to get into those categories,
the extreme.
The extremes, thank you. We've got to have these conversations with these people as options to help them.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the majority of people are not the extremes.
So we're talking 1% of underweight and quote unquote overweight, like the 1% at each end.
Yes, we're talking about bell curves right here. We're talking about the ends of bell curves. So I think in those patients, when we've got extreme cases, these are conversations that need to be had.
Yeah.
Now, we get into talking about kids, and as someone who's a family physician and takes care of children, boy, oh boy, does this get quite delicate and scary, right? And I, you know, I watched that episode, and as a mom, I'm watching that thinking, I would do anything to help my kids and not put them in a position where they are being ridiculed, potentially. You know, if somebody told me that my kid was not going to live past 18, I'm going to do whatever they recommend to help that child. So we can't be shaming parents, first of all, or blaming parents, right? They're doing the best they can in most every case to take care of their children. But I think that those AAP recommendations that came out for a lot of us kind of made us gasp. Woo, these are big interventions for kiddos. Now, again, it does come back to, Steph, when we bring highlights to these types of things and start to pass recommendations from big academies, it does open doors for opportunity to help people in those extreme of cases. So I'm trying to see, you know, every side of this.
Yeah. And I mean, the extreme, the 1% on each side, the end of the bell curve, that is not most people. 99% of the people listening to this show, they're in the bell curve, or their child is in the bell curve. It's just, I was put on a diet at 12, and thank God there was no weight loss drug in 1987, because I would have been suggested to be on a weight loss drug. But what happened to a 13-year-old who's put on a weight loss drug? Like, we're still talking 80 years in front of her. She's going to be on the drug for 80 years?
Sure. And then we've got,
it's mind-boggling, you know, right?
It is mind-boggling. And, you know, these are children that are in a adolescent phase of being around puberty. When is that happening? How is that playing into things? It also doesn't fix all of the potential underlying issues of access to, number one, healthcare and continued healthcare. Number two, access to the food and exercise and movement and psychiatric and psychologic interventions that need to be in place, regardless of if a child is on a medication or not, or has bariatric surgery or not. All of those things need to be, the wraparound services need to be in place, right? I think what happens, and I've seen it a lot in practice of pediatrics or family med, where we're taking care of kiddos and seeing, you know, trending weights, the discussion is this immediate fear of, oh my God, a child's going to gain weight. They're jumping the growth curve. What's going to happen? And that comes into that nuance of practice of children are growing and they're supposed to grow. They're not supposed to go the other direction. And how can we wrap around services around families that are sustainable, approachable, realistic, and not shaming and fat phobic?
Well, I think you hit the chord for me is like, how is that family introduced to the concept of fat phobia and weight stigma, and how the parents themselves, like, okay, how much of your fear for your child is actually just fat phobia playing out? Let's have a therapy around that before even making the final decision of putting your 14-year-old on through surgery, or because how much of the fear of the parent is the internalized and externalized fat phobia is playing out.
And it's
if we're removing the end of the bell curve, like we're just talking about the middle ground.
Yes. And you brought up, you know, diets in children. And I think when we start to talk about medications and bariatric surgery in kids, let's also talk about just the gasp and fear of putting a child on a diet.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, I'm not
I'm minimizing diets here, but it's as traumatic as
diets
or intervention.
You know, I have the patients who have been on Weight Watchers since age 7. That's traumatizing. That's traumatic. That's a big deal. And I'm not talking about we're going to go through our cabinets at home and try and increase nutrient dense foods in our home. We're going to try and get rid of some of the processed stuff in our house. We're going to try and take walks as a family. I'm talking about putting kids on calorie restricted diets, taking them to Weight Watchers, you know, shaming their food choice. One end of your mouth, you're saying clean plate club. The other end, you're saying you shouldn't be eating that. You know, I'm talking about these inconsistencies in messaging that we have toward kids, that those things are having severe long-term consequences for children.
And that induced the binge-restrict cycle as an emotional coping mechanism. That's what happened to me. I was eating in secret.
Yes.
I was being called a whatever terrible name, and I would go in my room and eat, right? Because I didn't know how to deal with the emotion of being shamed because of the size of my body.
Yes.
So anything else you would like to point out that I didn't ask question from your perspective?
Well, hey, what did you think about them having Weight Watchers on there? Having the Weight Watchers representative?
To me, it's so there's something, and I did some research. I did some research to find out what is really underneath this, because so if Oprah sold all her share in Weight Watchers and gave them good for her donation, but I bet you there's something that's going to come out in a few years that people were invested in a drug company. And good for Weight Watcher, they declare, we're a weight loss drug company now. We're like, we've changed our statement, and we're pushing weight loss drugs. Well, I don't agree with them, but at least they came out clean. They're not pretending to be something else anymore. They're a weight loss drug company. But I still don't believe there's nothing in for Oprah.
That was how I felt. It felt sticky. The show, the episode felt sticky to me. And it felt sticky because, first of all, I don't blame the physicians that we're on, not because they're colleagues, you know, we're all in this together. I don't blame them. We need to have physicians in these drug companies weighing in and telling people what it's actually like to do practice. But it was like, okay, we've got docs that work for these companies. Couldn't we have one who doesn't, you know, just to like see the other side of it? Okay, we've got Weight Watchers here. Cool. We've got all these people who do great on these medications and one person who didn't.
For like a minute.
Yes, exactly. So it was just very like, it just felt a little biased to me. And I left it feeling like disappointed. My overall way I felt from the episode was disappointed, I'd say, in the end.
Oh, disappointed and something's missing. For me, like there's an under thingy that's going to come out a few years from now when a very smart journalist is going to dig out the shit, and then we're going to find out, boom. This is why this was so weird.
Yes.
It because felt- it was weird.
Yes.
It was just weird. It felt like a commercial for weight loss drugs.
It did.
You know the 90s commercial, like the paid, like the, you know, the shit you used to watch at night, like the knife shit and all? It felt like that, the whole thing. They were selling us knives, like Japanese knife that cuts up through wood. That's what it felt like.
Well, you know, there's now some rumblings about these companies reaching out to fat activists as spokespeople for these meds. And it's like, well, Oprah is essentially one of those people.
Well, so Verge came out about 6 months ago. They reached out to her and like, oh my God, she went off the roof and did all kinds of work because they assume that automatically they want to lose weight. Right. And I wanted people to listen. It's a lot of work to personally accept the size of your body. And it takes a lot of work to say no to it, too.
Yes.
Because there's a ton of TV show reality. I don't follow TV reality, but some women that are on those reality shows that have been reached out by those drug companies that are now on the drugs. And they're saying body positivity was a scam. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
So that's going to be another show coming up with two other fat people of how body positivity is not a scam. It's because people hook on to it, but they never did the inner work of accepting who they are as people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I felt about Weight Watcher, your question. I mean, great to make the statement to declare their real value, but hoopli-doo, like.
It just felt forced. It felt forced.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, again, this is Stephanie's prediction, but I think when the real shit comes out, we're going to know why they had to make that statement to protect from whatever's going to come out at the other end.
I agree.
Stay tuned for post-game analysis number two.
Yes.
Anything else you want to add, Natalie? Dr.
No.
Natalie?
No. No, I appreciate it.
And you still work with people and you still can service people online. Am I correct if people are interested of reaching out to you and your company?
I do telemed in the state of Pennsylvania. I do lifestyle medicine consultations for people, and I am extremely active on social media as well, at Natalie Gentile MD on Instagram.
And what you heard, as I'll introduce you in the beginning, it's a weight neutral approach to health.
Yes.
Right? Thank you very much, Dr. Gentile.
Thank you.
Hey, my sisters, if you are loving what you are learning on the podcast, you have to come and check out our feminist mentorship masterclasses and our internationally recognized non-diet coaching certification on our website at www.stephaniedoze.com/shop. This is where you can get the individual coaching and the support to take the concept thought on the podcast to the next level, embrace our well-being in a way that will expand our collective freedom and power. Come and join myself and other women to learn how to reshape your mind, not your body. I'll see you there.